Hello, I'm Art Levine, host of the Straight Talk television show, now celebrating its 25th anniversary year on air. Over the past 25 years, we've recorded more than 500 shows and interviewed nearly 1,000 guests. As part of our 25th anniversary celebration, we have selected 25 of our most memorable shows to re-air as Straight Talk classics. This show is one of those classics. We trust you will enjoy seeing a part of Long Beach history, one of the many political leaders who have been our guest, or some of the nationally known actors, singers, and distinguished speakers who have visited us. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a Straight Talk Classic. The Straight Talk Classic series is brought to you through the generous support of SCAN, celebrating 40 years of keeping seniors healthy and independent. Good evening and welcome to Straight Talk. We have a very special edition of our show tonight featuring a distinguished speaker who is here appearing at Cal State Long Beach. I'll be talking with syndicated columnist and author Arianna Huffington about the impact of the new media on politics. Stay with us for this fascinating conversation.
Join us for tonight's edition of Straight Talk. And now your host, Art Levine.
I'm Art Levine, professor of ethics and legal studies from the College of Business Administration. Our guest today is Arianna Huffington. Ms. Huffington is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post and a nationally syndicated columnist. She has authored 13 books, most recently Third World America, about the decline of the middle class. She's a true pioneer in the use of the new media and is one of the most frequently cited media brands on the internet. Ms. Huffington is here as part of the CSULB Distinguished Speaker Series. Welcome to Cal State Long Beach, Arianna.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Art.
We're delighted that you're here. And the topic of your address here on campus is politics and the new media. I know from my own experience that the new media has changed everything. And, you know, we're a little show here, but our signal is viewable all over the country. We're not CBS, but the word can get out. So there's a sense of democratization of the media with the internet.
Oh, absolutely. It's really has changed everything. You know, you used to be able to express your opinions and have a platform only if you're a big name or if you owned the printing presses. And now you can have a voice and you can break through the static if you have something to say that resonates with people.
So the little guy or gal who has something to say can get his or her voice heard without being Rupert Murdoch.
Exactly. And, you know, the use of social media, Facebook, Twitter, sharing what you have to say with others has also revolutionized everything. You know, Will.i.am recently said that people used to consume news sitting on the couch, and now they consume news galloping on a horse.
Wow.
You know, they don't just consume it. They want to pass it on, to share it, to add something to it. And that's what has been so difficult for many in the mainstream media to understand. They're asking, you know, why are people updating Wikipedia entries for free? Why are they adding things on the Facebook walls for free? Why are they blogging for the Huffington Post for free? And the truth is that self-expression for many people has become the new entertainment. You know, nobody asked why are people sitting on the couches watching bad TV for free? But that's changed. People are much more engaged in what they're doing.
And this is a healthy thing for a democracy.
I think it's incredibly healthy. Like with every new stage in our evolution, there are problems. I think the biggest problem is the people who hide behind anonymity,
yeah,
to vent, to go for ad hominem attacks, basically to just completely screw up the conversation. And that's why at the Huffington Post we are very particular that we don't allow that. You know, we have not just the most advanced technology we can get to filter through comments, but we also have 30 human comment moderators. whose job is to make sure that technology is working or that they catch the things that technology didn't catch. And, you know, there are mistakes, but last month we had 3.5 million comments.
My God. One of the challenges, of course, is finding the funds to create the good content. I've always believed that content is king, and I think that ultimately will be true in the web as elsewhere. Many websites are what they call repeaters, and they don't originate stuff, but they take it from somewhere else and link it. Yours, I know, has a lot of original stuff, and yet content is expensive to create, and I think ultimately people will be asked to and will pay for content of a site that they believe in.
Well, here's what I believe. I believe that we are now living in the linked economy. Linked economy. And links are very valuable. And links can be monetized. So
links can be monetized. There's a value to links. I got to think. Go ahead.
Well, here's what's happened. Let's say you write an article for the New York Times, and we want to link to it from the Huffington Post. That will basically drive more traffic to the New York Times that the New York Times can monetize. And as long as the aggregators or the curators are following fair use laws and they don't accept more than what is allowed by the law.
But a link means the whole article.
Yes, but sometimes you can take a paragraph to basically introduce your readers to what the article is about, or you can link out directly, you know, either. Can be within
is that
the
valuable to
practice.
The New York Times
Incredibly.
To have a one-paragraph reference about the article?
Well, provided with a of course it is. Yes, we get hundreds of requests every day from mainstream media to link to their stories because it's incredibly valuable. Now, in our case, you know, we do three things. We do this kind of aggregation / curation. We have original reporters. And now that we've become profitable this year, we are adding to our reporting
team. I saw that you got Howard Fineman,
who is
one of my favorites.
We got Peter Goodman from the New York Times, who's become our business editor.
Now, that doesn't mean that they're leaving the other publication, but they're also adding.
Oh, no, they're leaving.
They're leaving.
Publications, yes.
They're leaving.
Howard Fineman is now full-time with the Huffington Post.
Really?
He left Newsweek.
Let me just cut to the chase. At some point, with Howard Fineman's and that like that are right at the top of their craft, it costs money to do that. Won't you, at some point down the line, ask your viewers to maybe pay $1 a week or $1 a month, and you have 25 million unique visitors a month, and if you get just half of them, that's not a bad cash flow.
Okay, let me give you an absolutely unequivocal answer.
Yes.
Never.
Okay,
never.
You heard it here. You will not have to pay to visit the Huffington Post.
Never. Our business plan is entirely advertising based.
Okay.
So it's basically bringing in advertisers, bringing in sponsors, bringing in sponsor-generated content. There are many new ways to bring in advertising on the site, but we're never going to go behind paywalls.
Wonderful. Why do you think that the cutting edge use of the media, of the web, like Huffington Post, is not being done by newspapers, who all now have websites, but by others like yourself?
Well, one of the reasons is precisely the question you asked. A lot of newspapers are trying to have it both ways. They want to put some of their content behind paywalls. They don't quite understand how news consumption has changed, how habits have changed. And also, we are, for example, mixing it up. We are having very established reporters like Howard or like Peter Goodman from the New York Times. And we also have young reporters. In fact, one of the things that we're going to accelerate is hiring young journalists right after they graduate, either journalism schools or you know, Yale. In fact, we just hired somebody who was the
good choice
arts editor at the Yale Daily News. He just graduated last year. This is his first job. He's fantastic. You know, there is incredible talent.
You have an affinity for young people, don't you? I can
absolutely
just see it.
You know, that wouldn't happen at the New York Times because they would want you to have paid your dues, so to speak, you know, to have gone and worked in other papers. We really believe that there are so many talented young people who've done actually great journalism with their school newspapers, and we'd love them to come on. In fact, if anybody's listening, we are hiring.
That, and we'll put we'll tell you how to get a hold of Arianna at the end of the show. But you heard it spontaneously from our guest. Well, you know, this there's so many implications of the new media, and in the next segment we're going to focus on the political use of it. But you are also an author, and you just came out September 7th with your 13th book, Third World America. Briefly tell us about the decline of the middle class here in America.
Well, obviously, this is a very startling title because we're not yet Third World America. The reason I picked that title is because I wanted to sound an alarm while there is still time to course correct.
Yes.
And right now, we can still avoid the iceberg hitting the Titanic. But the trajectory we are on is a very dangerous one. And there are many data I can point out to, including our crumbling infrastructure, that would turn us into a third world country. But the really significant decline is the decline of the middle class. Yeah.
And the gap between the wealthy and the poor, the discrepancy between the average CEO wage and the average worker that used to be 30 or 40 to 1 is now 1,000 to 1. It's a real danger.
It's like amazing what has happened in the last 30 years. This didn't just happen because of the recent almost financial meltdown. Yeah. This sort of decline started in 1980. And through successive administrations, Republican and Democrat, it really continued. And right now, we have something which is very un-American, which is that upward mobility for millions of Americans has become downward mobility. And upward mobility has always been at the heart of the American dream.
That the kids live better than the parents.
Exactly.
And now they can't afford the house.
Now we have two-thirds of Americans in a recent survey who said that they expect their children to be worse off than they are. And if you look at international data, we are 10th in upward
mobility. So why is that?
Well, what has happened is that through special interest buying public policy, we basically deregulated a lot of the practices, you know, of mortgage companies, credit card companies, or we basically...
Laissez-faire.
Or we allowed... the regulators to be captured by the regulated, because that's another problem. When Fannie and Freddie had regulators, they had entire agencies regulating them.
Yeah.
But they were not really regulating them. We saw the same thing around the BP oil spill. They had regulators. The mining disaster.
Asleep at the switch.
Asleep at the switch.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating, and it has profound political implications. And in the next segment of our show, we're going to ask Arianna her analysis of what this all means for politics and get her take on the midterm elections that are coming up and also on the Obama administration. You won't want to miss the rest of this show.
Electricity is different from any other product we use. We can't store it. We must use it wisely, but can't do without it completely. And there's no substitute for this special form of energy that brings us light, comfort, and progress. That's why California needs new standards that can keep utilities strong, guard against another power crisis, and protect consumers from the kind of shortages that often affect other commodities. Because electricity is different.
When the Port of Long Beach employs more people for new projects and construction workers for improvements, it has a positive effect for local businesses like my restaurant, Las Islitas. The port keeps the whole community busy. Especially our cook, Jorge.
The Port of Long Beach, investing in jobs, investing in you.
We are back, continuing our conversation, fascinating conversation with Arianna Huffington, who's here at California State University Long Beach as our speaker for the fourth annual Distinguished Speaker Series program. And we want to focus now on the subject of her presentation on campus, politics and the new media. This revolution really has had profound impact on politics, and spell it out as you see it.
Well, first of all, we see something that we could not have imagined before, which is politicians being able to go directly to the people through social media. Sarah Palin actually has been a master at this. She doesn't need to do interviews. She can just update her status on her Facebook profile. She can Twitter. She now also, on top of it, has a reality show happening out in Alaska, you know, Sarah's Alaska. So the social media used by politicians, again, can be used for good or for bad. She can post something about death panels in the healthcare legislation, which is completely untrue.
I get Dear Arthur emails from the President of the United States. Now, I don't know, I know he's not writing to me personally, but still, that connection. And of course, the Obama administration used the media so effectively in their campaign, did they not?
Oh, yes,
they really wrote the book on
it. They wrote the book, and they also were able to do what the Howard Dean campaign was not able to do, which is to translate the viral into the actual, you know, to take what was happening, the activity that was happening online, and actually use it to raise real money.
Real money and real people knocking on
doors. Real people knocking on doors. And I remember when I was in Chicago visiting the Obama campaign, and I had asked to meet with Chris Hughes, who had come from Facebook to run their digital campaign. And I was meeting him at a hotel, and I was waiting. I thought and waiting, and 20 minutes passed, and it suddenly dawned on me that the kid sitting at that table was that I thought was waiting for his parents was Chris Hughes. And that's the thing. They brought in people who really knew what they were doing.
I wrote them an email after they won suggesting, I mean, dumb me, that they need this, that they should continue that personal touch as part of the administration, which, of course, they have. And, I mean, getting personal letters from the President of the United States, personal emails, you know, it's kind of touching.
But they haven't really continued in the way it worked during the campaign. You know, they put it all under the auspices of the DNC. And so it became much more rote and bureaucratic, and, you know, it has been ramped up now that the president is campaigning for his fellow Democrats.
They ran a much better campaign than many feel the first 2 years of the administration has been.
Yes, I write in Third World America that they went from the audacity of hope and what David Plouffe, his campaign manager, called the audacity to win, to the timidity of governing.
Wow.
Because, you know, it's ironic that his opponents are basically claiming that he has been very radical, but he has not. He has been, in the end, very cautious in terms of tackling the biggest crisis we're facing, which is joblessness.
He has a incredible training as a lawyer from Harvard and all, but he has a tendency to try and bring everyone together, which often means splitting the differences rather than, and whatever you think of Ronald Reagan, there were certain core principles that he stood for, and you could go with him or not go with him, but you knew where he was. A lot of people have trouble identifying just what are the core principles of the president.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think it's great to bring everybody together. But you can't bring everybody together if you're not clear about what direction you're going towards. And, you know, we saw that during every major struggle in this country, whether it was the Emancipation Proclamation or the 19th Amendment or the civil rights struggle, you know, you could not come together until people were willing to accept certain core principles.
Yes. And he's faced with a moment of truth on this gaze in the military because he has to decide whether or not to appeal it.
as an administration, the federal judge said it's unconstitutional, and if he doesn't appeal it, then it stays. But if he appeals it because he wants to wait for Congress to do it, it gets muddied.
Well, it does get muddy, and very often it gets particularly muddy when the White House is hyper-concerned about how what they do is going to be used by the opposition. We're seeing that in Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We're seeing that in our policy in Afghanistan. You know,
no Democrat wants to be soft on national security.
Exactly, but it's really tragic to be making war and peace decisions based on how the opposition is going to approach
them. Do you think the administration is?
You know, you have Bob Woodward in his new book who said the president is psychologically, that was his term, out of Afghanistan. What does that mean? You know, how can you be psychologically out of a war that's ongoing where young men and women are being killed and where we are spending $2.8 billion a week? And that to me is stunning at a time when our local governments are cutting schools and services and when we need to do nation building here at home.
Yeah. Well, we could have rebuilt every school in America for one year's cost of the war.
Yes, and we could have rebuilt a lot of schools for what we spent bailing out Wall Street.
Give us your take on the gubernatorial and senatorial races here in California.
Well, the gubernatorial race seems to be less of a toss-up than it was a few weeks ago. It seems that Jerry Brown is now ahead by 8 points. The Senate race is more of a toss-up. And I think a lot will depend on turnout, who comes out to vote, and also on how much of the wave that has been going Republicans' way continues to go Republicans' way.
You know, Sacramento is totally dysfunctional, and everyone knows it, gerrymandered districts and the whole litany, and the Democrats really deserve to be thrown out wholesale for this mess. Our credit rating is down at the bottom and everything, but Democrats are going to win. It's a Democratic state, and maybe they made the mess, maybe they can fix it. There's a new commercial out for Jerry Brown called Twins that is absolutely devastating, and it's making the internet circuit. You don't have to spend a lot of money to get your message out. You don't have to spend $120 million.
No, you just need a lot of creativity.
Yeah.
And then something can go viral, and it's perfect.
Tell us a little bit about Arianna. I mean, you were born in Greece, you went to England, you went to Cambridge, you were president of the Debating Society, you've written 13 books, you've created a pioneering website. Where do you get your energy from? Where did this all come from?
Well, I'm very blessed that I love what I'm doing. I feel very grateful that I don't really separate my work from my life. You know, I love my work.
There's a saying that maybe you'd agree with, that if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life.
Oh, I love that. That's how I feel. I feel that it's a real blessing to be able to call work what you actually love to do. Yeah. And with the Huffington Post now, it's really a great opportunity to have a platform, a vehicle that we can use to have some real impact on what's happening.
Would it be an extreme to call it that you feel like you're on a mission?
Well, you know, I feel I'm a bit on a mission. And I feel that I'm as an immigrant to this country, I feel really grateful for what this country has given me.
Yes.
There's no other country I would rather live in. I have two daughters who were born here. And I feel that this is an opportunity for us to really have a bit of a value reset about what we value, what matters to us. And as we are moving into this new epoch, you know, John Ossoff used to talk about moving from Epoch A, which was based on competition and survival, to Epoch B, which is based on collaboration and meaning. So as we are moving in that direction, we have incredible opportunities to become more connected with each other and more creative about everything we do.
Have you found that the younger generation, I forget whether it's X or Y or Z these days, but are much more attuned to community and helping and less of the avaricious?
Absolutely. But also, I find all across America. So I've been crisscrossing the country, first researching the book, then on my book tour.
Selling the book.
First researching, then selling. And in both instances, you know, it's been amazing to see how much creativity and compassion has been unleashed. And often, you know, when people are in trouble, you see what they're made of, and we're seeing that.
Some of the best, you know, this Chile miner story was so moving. The country came together. They spared no expense to save these 33 miners. The president was there, hugging. It reminded me almost of Apollo 13.
I know, you're so right about that. But these are also reminders of what we are made of, what human beings are made of, which so often we forget because people sometimes crumble at the slightest difficulty.
Or they rise to the occasion.
Or they rise to the occasion, yeah.
So maybe existentially that explains why the good Lord gives us these problems so that we can rise to, to address them. Let me mention the book again, Third World America, Arianna's 13th book. So she must be doing something right. We coming down to the last 2 minutes. What closing thoughts would you like to leave our viewers with about the future and society?
Well, I suppose my parting thought is that even though the book is called Third World America, and even though I'm sounding the alarm about the decline of the middle class, I really profoundly believe, and I lay that out in section 5. So if you only have time to read one section, section 5 it is, the solution section. So I argue that all around the country, people are doing amazing things. You know, they are creating their own jobs, often by using social media, going to Etsy.com or Bonanza.com. It's stunning what's happening. And then they're actually turning to what they have in abundance. You know, they may not have a job, but they may have time on their hands or skills they're not using. So you have lawyers coming together to help people avoid foreclosure. You have an unemployed concierge I write about in Portland, Oregon, who started a site called WeVeGotTimeToHelp.org.
Wow.
And bringing together unemployed people, helping people in need.
There is no deeper satisfaction than helping others. I mean, I grew up very spoiled and self-indulged, and it took me a lot of time to work my way out of that. But thank God I did. But well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for coming to the campus of California State University, Long Beach, to address both the students and the community on your work and on your theme. And it's been a real pleasure to have you on our show here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, we want to thank Arianna again for joining us, and thank you at home for watching. Please be with us again. Good night.
This Straight Talk Classic show has been brought to you through the generous support of SCAN, celebrating 40 years of keeping seniors healthy and independent.
Children, we got to come together and share the good feeling. 'Cause nothing ever gonna make this world better if we don't start believing that love really, really, really is the answer. Everybody join hands, 'cause it's time now. Up one another, shine a light from every heart.